Hi, it's Brendan here. Before we get into this week's episode of the podcast, I want to let you know about my next live event. At 7 p.m. on Tuesday the 15th of April, I'll be sitting down with the brilliant Julia Hartley Brewer, Talk TV presenter and Sun columnist. Julia and I will be live and in conversation via Zoom, talking about the mess Labour's made of Britain and the current state of the culture war. Plus, we'll be taking questions from you, the audience. If you want to tune in, this is a free event exclusive to Spike supporters, our online donor community. If you're already a Spike supporter, you can sign up for your ticket now on our online donor hub. And if you're not already a Spike supporter, now is the perfect time to become one. To celebrate Spike's 25th anniversary this year, we're offering a year's membership for just £25. That's half the usual cost. Becoming a Spike supporter means you can get a ticket to this event, as well as enjoying many other exclusive perks like ad-free reading, access to our comment section, and more free events like this one. To become a Spike supporter, go to spiked-online.com/donate. That's spiked-online.com/donate. And I'll see you there on Tuesday, the 15th of April at 7 p.m.
The vibe is shifting again, I think. I've been calling that Trump devotion syndrome, but and that did exist from like the beginning. So I think they're the opposite sides of the same coin. He's a cult of personality. This, I think, is what happens with a cult of personality, is that you either worship them or you loathe them. Even though Trump is telling people that tariffs are good for them, they know tariffs are tax. You know, they're not, they know that it's being passed down to them as a consumer. They're not idiots. People want to see material changes to their life.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Bridget Fettersy. Bridget, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me back. It's always so much fun.
It's great to have you back on because we need to figure out what's going on in America. It's so perplexing for some of us outside of the country. It's 70 days, I think, or thereabouts, coming up to 3 months that we've had Trump 2.0. Last time we spoke, you talked brilliantly about how excited you were actually to vote for Trump and to be part of that movement, even though you're not naturally part of the Republican Party or part of the right or whatever. How do you feel things are going? How's the vibe?
Well, it's funny, just to the last night at 2 a.m, I was like, the vibe is shifting again, I think. I think there's so much. I mean, I've been thinking and talking and discussing all of this stuff with people from various points of view for the past 5 days. It seems like it's coming up nonstop. So I don't really know where to begin. I think I begin with the cost of living. Look, it's only been 70 days. So the cost of living isn't going down. If anything, it's staying the same or going up, although egg prices did go down. And I think Americans really want to see some people want to see material changes to their life. You know, even here in Texas, insurance went up, taxes went up, everything. It's just like that creeping, everything going up, and in 5 years it's doubled. You know, it's just enough to be like, it's only like $100, but $100 over the course of 5 years, and it's now everything is doubled. So I think there's that aspect, and that might just be life. I don't think the tariff. Americans aren't dumb. I know people. I mean, we're dumb. It's weird. It's a weird paradox. We're dumb, probably the dumbest people in the world, and also not dumb and savvy in some ways. And I think even though Trump is telling people that tariffs are good for them, and in some ways it is, you're trying to bring jobs and you know, production back to the country, I don't think Americans buy that. They know tariffs are tax. You know, they're not, they know that it's being passed down to them as a consumer. They're not idiots. So it doesn't seem like And I think the stock market hasn't been looking great. So then you have all these people getting laid off. And the immigration thing, I think, is good. I think they've made a lot of progress, but because of, I don't know if it's the pressure to do it quickly or if there are quotas, I'm not exactly sure, but that adds a lot of room for mistakes, which it seems like even a couple of mistakes and kind of skirting due process is making people squeamish, rightfully. And, you know, sending people to these El Salvadorian prisons when they weren't guilty of any crimes, not great. I think those things are obviously very bad, but I also understand the rights perspective of saying, look, we didn't hear you guys crying at all about anybody coming into the country and the fact that they were letting thousands of criminals into this country for 4 years. So please spare me if one egg gets broken in our attempt to try and clean up this mess that you guys created. So I can see, unfortunately, being battered and tossed around and hated by everyone in the culture wars. I do understand kind of where both people are coming. Like, I have that same feeling of it's, you know, they had the famous kind of Ghibli meme that the White House put out from the Miyazaki font that was going around ChatGPT, which, if you didn't understand a word that I just said, God bless you for not being very online. And I understand kind of where both sides are coming on that too, where on the one hand, it looks crass. It seems beneath the White House to be kind of 4chan. This is what I've been calling the 4chaning of politics. You know, we've been here for a while, and now everybody's just fully embraced it, it seems. And I don't actually know if there's any going back. Like, we're suddenly going to become respectable again. It doesn't seem like things generally move in that direction until there's something major happens, unfortunately. So there's that aspect of it where it's like, oh, they're just, you know, hopping on a viral trend. We did a whole dumpster fire about this. It's dropping soon. And it's also like, oh, it's dehumanizing. Like, I get it. And then most people are like, whatever. I talk to normies. The interesting thing is, I talk to a lot of normies, and they are saying more to me, I don't know how you keep up with all of it because I can't, and I've basically just checked out. So there's a lot, you know, you have Elon, who I think most Amer again, most Am I was joking about this. I'm like, normies don't like open kitchens. They want to eat, but they don't want to see how their food is made. They just don't. It's like, we want deportations, but I don't want A, a lot of mistakes, and B, I would like some semblance of due process and not to have that completely shredded. And C, I would like to not have you guys like flaunting it and joking about it and kind of putting it in my face. Because I think Americans are actually nicer than most people give them credit for. And the disconnect between the very online and the very offline is quite vast. And online only really incentivizes cruelty. And I don't think the average American, even if we all have a little bit of cruelty in our heart because we're human and capable of that, I think Americans are try to, you know, think of themselves as helpful and nice people, or they like to fancy themselves that way, even if it's a delusion. I don't know. I'm all over the place. I'm sorry. I wrote a piece for Spectator too that like melted my brain last week because it started with a joke that I've been making on Dumpster Fire, which, and I thought it would be an easy column because I'm like, I've been joking about this for 2 years. And then once I started pulling the thread and getting underneath that joke, it was like, oh, this is evidence of civilization and collapse. Okay, well, that's depressing.
Yeah, I think some of those memes that the White House has been pushing out in relation to the deportations. I mean, when I first saw them, I thought it was so wild that I found it kind of entertaining just from the point of view that it was unheard of for an administration to do something like this. But then I thought, actually, this is a serious issue that millions of people voted for Trump to sort out in a serious way. And therefore, to treat it in this kind of like a circus just didn't feel right. But one thing that has struck me over the past couple of months is that there seems to be two types of Trump derangement syndrome at the moment. And you know me, I'm glad the Trump thing is happening in the same way that I'm glad Brexit happened, same way I'm glad that populism is happening in Europe. I like a shake-up, and my God, we really needed a shake-up. But it seems to me that you've got the old traditional form of Trump derangement syndrome. Trump's a fascist, Trump's Hitler, blah, blah, blah. But you've got this new form which thinks that Trump is the best thing since sliced bread. Nothing he does is wrong. Even the Signal chat controversy, which seems pretty serious to me, that plans to bomb the Houthis were leaked to accidentally to a journalist prior to the bombing. That seems pretty serious breach of security from my perspective. You have these two approaches to Trump, neither of which is helpful, I think.
Well, I've been calling that Trump devotion syndrome, but and that did exist from like the beginning. So I think there are two variations of TDS. They're the opposite sides of the same coin. And it is, he's a cult of personality. This, I think, is what happens with a cult of personality, is that you either worship them or you loathe them. There's a new strain, an offshoot of Elon derangement syndrome as well, which already kind of existed. You had the Elon stans and all the fanboys, and then as he became part of this administration and more in your face about what he was doing in the government, now you've seen it. There are people firebombing Teslas and whatnot. And this is again where it's like the left doesn't seem to learn, and they take up a lot of oxygen when they could just be quietly sitting there and letting everybody focus on Trump and that administration. Again, this is so much of like all of the media studies and the people who have talked about media, the idea that you post this meme and we used to be a country that could kind of talk about policy, and underneath this meme is a lot of policies that we should be having a rigorous debate about, and maybe that would be a great place to start that debate and conversation. And instead, you end up talking about the image itself, and no one's talking about the policies, or very few people.
Yeah, that is the danger, I guess, with the 4chaning of politics, as you aptly call it, where the circus becomes the focus rather than the policy and the question of what needs to be done and how might it be done. But it does, I did want to ask you your thoughts on the Signal chat thing, because I do find myself, it's like what you said at the start, where you can see both sides' point of view. So on the one hand, I think the idea that you hear from the Trump derangement sufferers that this is the worst thing that's ever happened and it's the end of American civilization and this is the most incompetent administration in history, blah, blah, blah. You think, no, no, that's going over the top. But then on the other side, where people say, you just know for a fact that the people making excuses for Trump, if this has had happened under the Biden administration, they'd still be talking about it now. They would still be saying that the senile old fool was leaking war secrets to journalists. What an idiot. What did you make of the Signal thing, and how did it land in America? How has it divided people?
But this is the same problem that we have, because you could also say that thing in reverse, which is, I don't want to hear from the people about this national security leak and what a failure it was when we had Afghanistan at the beginning of the Biden administration and no one was held accountable for that. And people died, American soldiers died, and not a single person lost their job or was fired. And the people who care about national security now suddenly, we're silent during that. So I have to compartmentalize and say, yes, that was incompetent. It's embarrassing. I wish they could just take the L, but because of the nature of our po political system, and it's like this wartime mentality between the two parties, no one is I admitting any kind of mistakes or even taking any kind of holding themselves accountable at all, because it doesn't really benefit them to do so. Both sides do this, the predominant parties. And I also, and it got kind of brushed over, and that, yes, the right would absolutely be talking about the senile old man who it could gave all of our American secrets away because he's incompetent. But on the other hand, I don't want to hear from the people who said nothing for 4 years when we had a doddering old man at the helm, and we don't even know if he was actually in charge. These couple of things, and this is why I think I've been thinking about this so much. And I had dinner with a right-wing commentator, Turley. It's Stephen Turley. He has this YouTube channel, Turley Talks, on which I've been a guest a few times, and he's very brilliant and insightful, and I love talking to him about things. But he was saying that, you know, we were talking about how everything feels really chaotic and broken, and the right is at war with each other. There's a lot of infighting, even within the individual parties, libertarians on the left wing, you have all of this dissent, and then everybody's kind of attacking each other. And he was using this term that I love, that I think he just came up with at dinner, was which is it feels like this cultural shrapnel. Like everything, we're kind of on the other side of this explosive change in everything. You know, we're in between the old normal and the new normal, and there's no way of knowing how any of this is going to shake out. So everybody's kind of grasping, and the vibes are shifting constantly. And you have these weather vane voters like myself who left the left and don't really feel at home in the right. And the right is now, because the left has abandoned all the social media platforms attacking, I think they're going to naturally start attacking this faction, because they're used to fighting and they don't have anyone to fight on those platforms anymore. And not to mention, there's just so much. There's so much going on right now. We're basically in the falling. It's like you're over the cliff and you're falling and you haven't hit the ground yet. So we're not on solid ground. And we're not on the ground we used to be on. We're just, it's like, and it's also post-normal. Mind you, we have lower belief in institutions. This is another thing I think the right is misreading this moment a little bit, where because you have such a strong cult of personality, and you had that in Trump 1.0 and still in 2.0, but the people who came over from the MAHA people, the Make America Healthy Again people, the RFK Jr. people, the lack of the collapse of institutional trust across the board has led to many conspiratorial, you know, thinking. And just, again, people are lost. They're looking for something to kind of hold on to in this weird free fall that I don't even think they know they're in. And that is, these people distrust the government no matter who is in charge. So some government that's going to come in, even if it's Trump, he'll have his people who love him, but there's a big group of people in America who are just like, I don't trust any of you, none of you. And you're not going to tell me what to do either. And you're not going to bullshit me either. And you're not going to spin this. And some people will believe it and some people will not. But I think that the biggest shift has been the move away from people trusting any of these institutions, no matter who is in charge of them. And once Trump is gone, we'll really start to see that shake out.
You make a really good point there, which I'm still thinking about, and I'm going to think about it more on the incompetence question and the fact that people who made excuses for the Biden administration are now making that accusation against Trump. You're so right to put it like that. I mean, this was an administration where we literally didn't know who was in charge. They literally went out and said, he's fine, he's grand, he's able-minded, and it just wasn't true. So to now say, oh, Trump is really incompetent, is just, it doesn't wash. And that does create that culture, I guess, where your instinct is less to say, yes, this was an incompetent act, they shouldn't have leaked these war plans, but more to say, hold on, who the hell are you guys to raise these criticisms when you failed to do it for the past 4 years? You wouldn't even let us do it when we could see the truth in front of our eyes. So it is that weird politics, isn't it, where you constantly find yourself fighting the enemy to such an extent that it sometimes gets hard to tell the truth as it exists.
Yeah, this is what I had Normie saying to me. I don't even know what's true. And now AI has entered the chat. We haven't even gotten to that, which is changing everything. So you're at a time where people don't trust anything. They don't believe anything. And now you have a tool that makes it even more possible to distrust everything around you. And it is what happens, I think, in that back and forth. If you're a person who's like, well, this is, I don't want to hear a single thing about indecency from the left. There were people caught having sex in this, like, there was a topless trans woman on the White House. I can list a million things that would be considered indecent that came out of that White House during those 4 years. And what happens is, I think, if you're not tribal, if you're not in that, which I believe still a lot of Americans can kind of, enough Americans have left either one of their party that they're still seeing the kind of flaws in both parties. But what happens is everyone's incompetent. Everyone's indecent. You go, well, I don't want to hear from you. And I was kind of hoping you guys might bring some semblance of stability, because I think people are looking for some kind of competence. They're just hoping and praying that someone's going to come in. You know, they were promised that the adults in the room would be returned with Biden. You did not have that at all. Then I don't know. I don't think I had any illusion about it being an absolute dumpster fire, but I think a lot of people hope that he was a little bit more, you know, Susan Wilde, like Susan Wilde has like wrangled him a bit, but you can't wrangle these people. He's the richest man in the world, and Trump, who doesn't listen to anybody, and now they have power. And my fear is, it does give me insight, and I don't know whether this comes from the left or the right, to be honest, but it does give me insight into how authoritarians rise in these moments when people are worried about their finances. There's battles around immigration. You see this in Europe too. This is why Americans are like, shut up, Europe. We don't want to hear from you. You guys are fucked. Like, good luck. You guys had to ban ninja swords in the UK. I don't even want to take, you know, they're like, oh, Europeans are having the lowest opinion of Americans. Like, oh no, what are we going to do? And it's funny that was kind of reflected in that Signal chat, that like real disdain for Europe that exists, or just the like, I don't know. It's very strange right now. It feels, and talking about the AI, I think we are, and this is something that Dr. Trolley and I were talking about, we are in this like post-normalcy period. And it does, I get it. I get how a strong man can come along and kind of give people who are feeling all of this stuff we're talking about, the confusion, the tension, that I don't know it's real, and say, well, I have the answers. I'm a stable force.
What about the state of wokeness? Because one of the reasons that you went for Trump at the election, and you talked about this prior to the election, and you caused a stir actually when you said, listen, this is why I'm voting for Trump, because the left went insane. It gave up on fighting for better living standards for working class people and equality for women and all those other good things, and became this kind of hysterical, deranged, identity obsessed movement that was thought that if a man cut off his penis, he became a woman and all that other lunacy. How do you think the woke stuff stands? Because Trump seems to me, of the good things he's done, he has taken a cudgel to wokeness. And my favorite thing he's done so far is his executive order on men in women's sport. It was so clearly written, so clearly expressed. And that image of him surrounded by those girls as he signed it, I just found that a very moving image. And so it summed up everything about our politics, that it fell to a man like him, who's not exactly, right on or anything. It fell to a man like him to do that because the left has gone so insane. You could never envision the left signing a document in favor of women's rights while surrounded by beaming young girls. You just can't see them doing it. How's that stuff going in terms of Trump's war on woke?
I think it's good. I don't, I distrust the idea that you can. It's weird. There's so much like talking out of both sides of everyone's mouth at the moment that, and I think again, it's because of these chaotic times, it almost forces you to do so. But I saw like everybody was calling some of the stuff that Rachel Zegler from the Snow White unhinged, saying unhinged. And it was. But I'm also like, she's 23. She was 21. She got this part when she was 19. We were all idiots when we were 19 to 23. 23 is peak. I think I know everything. And then you start getting hit by the dick of life and you never feel quite as. Maybe guys and women, maybe some men and women have a longer run, but I think 23 is really peak. Like I've got this all figured out. Arrogance. You're just young enough to still be ignorant and arrogant like that, and you're old enough to think that you're kind of like a wise old person. And I feel like people were holding her to this standard. I'm like, you're gonna give her crap for being unhinged, and we have a White House posting memes. Like you can't hold these people to the same to a standard. It just seems like ridiculous to hold this girl to this standard. And I know a lot of the arguments and she's doing a job, whatever. I also think it's like I also have a theory that it's a middle-aged woman's excuse to dunk on someone younger and prettier that's acceptable. Like it's a bullying thing. And men who are obsessed with Disney movies just creep me out and weird me out. And when the right and the left engage in this discourse, I'm like, what is your, this is so weird, guys. Why are you so obsessed with this? But really, my point of even bringing this up is that you can't say that this is a woke mind virus and all of these kids are being indoctrinated and then not expect them to act like they're indoctrinated. So either they're indoctrinated or they're not. Because if they're indoctrinated, they're saying exactly what you would expect them to be saying as indoctrinated people. And now we have to figure out how to deprogram them. But you don't get to attack. I don't think attacking them is going to exactly encourage them to deprogram. So you either believe that they're indoctrinated or you don't believe it, or you have no idea how to handle someone who's actually been indoctrinated and needs your help and guidance getting deprogrammed. Attacking them and piling on is not the way to do it. Wokeness is an ideology. It is not something you're just going to snuff out. If it is an idea, you're not, you can do, I think it's smart that they're making policies. I wish more of them were actually voted into law because I'm tired of like this executive order presidency ping-ponging back and forth. And make Congress actually do their job for once. And I like seeing that this stuff is being, you know, some of these policies are being like pulled out by the roots because they're not good. And the DEI stuff, like all of this stuff, the policies that were put in place do need to come out and have to be reformed. But I'm not sure that ideology is going to die. And last night at 2 in the morning, when I couldn't sleep because all of this is running around in my brain, I was thinking about, and I'd been talking to somebody about how, like the woke right thing. I'm sure you've seen this from James Lindsay, Ever the Canary in the Coal Mine, and Constantine Kissins talked about this. And I don't like the term. I have like a weird knee-jerk reaction to it. But really, I do understand it I feel like I'm seeing more of what they're saying, but really what happened was it's postmodernism that took over everything. Like they just that got into the left and it infected the entire way we do politics. And now it's just there. That it is all of the things that you kind of critique about left-wing postmodernism and the woke mind virus. It is essentially I understand what he's saying more. Now that I've sat down and talked to him, I understand that he's just applying everything that he learning about, deconstructivism, problematizing everything. But again, too, this is also just wartime morality. That is the place we're in. It's like that whole idea of new rules that the right has, where it's like new rules. Well, okay, so now you're just gonna fight like them and apply all of their lack of principles or whatever their new standards or operating procedures are to your party, which I can understand now why they would call it the woke right, even though I still bristle at that term. And now everybody gets to do whatever they want because we're at war.
Yeah, it's yes, exactly right. And I completely agree with you on the Rachel Zegler thing. I just thought, the bullying of her online is crazy. Of course, she talks nonsense, but show me a young person who doesn't, especially one who is as feted and celebrated and stuck in the Hollywood machine as she is. It makes perfect sense that she would do that. But it does seem that, she became a punch bag for this kind of exasperated anti-woke right-wing men or women, as you say. And there is this tendency, instead of have a kind of logical, rational discussion about the problem society faces, you look for a kind of demonic figure who you can attack to let off your steam. And that's what happened to her. I thought it was really out of order. But on the woke right thing, it's interesting to hear you say that. I also have a problem with the term woke right, because it makes me think of right-wing people who are woke in the sense that they're pro-trans and they're into the climate change, and those right-wing people do exist, especially in the Conservative Party here in Britain. There are woke conservatives. So I just get confused when I hear woke right, because I think it means something slightly different. I refer to it as the crank right, which is not really satisfactory either, but there is a problem, isn't there, with this culture? Is it as straightforward as saying that wokeness was awful and now anti-wokeness risks becoming awful too? Do you think there's something in that?
Yeah, it again, I'm very conflicted about this stuff. I feel and I feel like I've said this on this podcast, if it's interesting if the right, there seems to be no extreme to the left that is too far in America. You can firebomb Tesla. The things you get away with on the left are absolutely insane. And the minute the country kind of takes 1 millimeter of an inch to the right, is there's this knee-jerk but the right reaction. I see it in myself as someone who is raised progressive and liberal. I have had to, in order to even vote for Trump, I had to kind of root that out and be aware of it, of that tendency to be always kind of, it's almost like a verbal tic where you're also having to be like, but Trump or but the right. And so I see a lot of that in this. So there's again a lot here. A lot of this is people battling over who's going to be in charge of brainwashing the plebs. It's people competing for market share. It's easy for people who got massive audiences leaving the left to now gatekeep a little bit. There is a certain aspect of that that I see where it's like, oh, it's very nice of you to be gatekeeping for the right person who just got to the right. Like, you don't, and there's a lot of self-congratulation going on there, where as you're seeing a lot more of this infighting even in the center, people will be like, well, I push back against the illiberalism of the left. Like, you don't get to pat yourself on the back for realizing late way later than what the right's basically been saying for decades and warning about for decades in many instances. You don't get to just be like, well, I pushed back against this when it mattered. You're like, not really. Not really. You really just started parroting talking points that the right's been saying, and you did it maybe in a little bit more of an intellectual way. And you had more status because you came from academia or you came from those circles that were considered elite and high status. And you look down on the right and the right-wing media as low status. And so, therefore, your ideas were more acceptable to other people who might have been feeling that way. But you don't, like, come on now. You're not some brave hero who stood up. All of us were late. All of us. I was saying things very early and had social professional costs for it. And I still feel like I was too late. Like, I should have been braver earlier, said something earlier, noticed what was going on earlier. And I didn't. So there's that aspect too of, I think a lot of it is just people competing for market share and trying to act like it's that they're standing up to the woke right, and they're really trying to gatekeep and keep those low status right wing people who are right all along separate from them so that they can grab more of that market share. Now, we do have a problem on the right. I still don't know how much power they have. Even being in power, I don't know how much power they actually wield. They seem huge online. The anti-Semitism thing is a real problem everywhere. People want to deny it. They want to say, oh, this is what you call label everything. There was a great clip going viral yesterday where it said it's not enough to be like anti-Semitic. It's not enough to be against anti-Semitism. You have to be anti-. It was very like woke. And I think if the right starts adopting that kind of language and they do start punishing people for things they wrote that are anti-Israel, it's going to make all of this worse. It's going to exacerbate these problems because that, I mean, you want to talk about the original mind virus, it's anti-Semitism. And people, once they get this, it seems like they cannot focus on anything else. It is wild. And they don't even realize it. But then suddenly everything, it does become that meme where it's like, it all links back to the Jews. And you're like, oh no. Oh no.
It's the high point, or I guess the low point, of every conspiracy theory. And you can see it happening in real time now. You can actually, we have a ringside seat to a real time falling down the well of anti-Semitism. I mean, this kind of stuff used to happen, behind closed doors. And certainly in the pre-internet era, of course, it would happen in closed meetings and, secret handshakes, and anti-Semitism would grow like that. But now we can see it actually happening to individuals. And I did want to ask you about the anti-Semitism stuff, because it does seem to me that a clear connection between the woke left and the woke right, or whatever we decide to call it in the end, is this problem with Jews. And it is a common experience. So on the left, you have a kind of antagonism with Israel that very often, and I completely agree with you that we absolutely should not be throwing people out of the country or arresting them for criticizing Israel. And I want to ask you about that in a minute. There is a criticism of Israel that very often crosses the line into something a bit darker. You now
Oh,
see
yeah.
it on a lot of the right, the crank right, or whatever we call it. You see a lot of this stuff, which is very anti-Israel, but also quite explicitly anti-Semitic. What have you made of that? Did it surprise you that this stuff has taken off as quickly as it has?
I don't think it has because I started seeing it was one of the things that pushed me out of the left was seeing this and seeing how rampant it was and how in academia. And then you have TikTok and the young people, even young people I talk to, because they're astute in these kind of ideas that present themselves as just asking questions. You know, a lot of this stuff, like they again, there's something youthful about it. You come forth and you say, I just discovered they're not teaching us this about. It's like, this is the most studied war in history. No, and these people, by the way, the people who had issues with it, the David Irvings, these people had their ideas challenged, tested. They were debating these ideas in real time. It wasn't like now where you can cherry pick information from somebody who had his ideas debunked in real time and say, well, look at what I've noticed, you know, and now everybody's suddenly noticing and you're like, oh God. And having that lack of historical perspective that this is like anti-Semitism is kind of the one of the, if not the, I asked Grok, I said, what's the oldest long-standing conspiracy? And I asked it what the oldest conspiracies were, and there are some that they think that were in like Babylon and all these ancient Egypt. There's another one around a pharaoh who's maybe murdered. And then I said, what's the oldest like long-standing? And it said nothing beats the blaming the Jews for everything. Like it just, and it almost always precedes World War. It always happens in these times when people are looking for a scapegoat. They're looking for somebody to blame. It's very confusing times. There's a kind of wartime morality that has spewed over into the populace, which excuses anything on your side. Or, and I don't know, I can't help but be like, yeah, this is what we were saying on Dumpster Fire just yesterday when we shot it. I was like, we're in the montage sequence they play in the apocalypse movies that shows you how you ended up in the apocalypse and like whatever dystopia that you're in. And by the way, all dystopias are on the table right now. So I think that, and just seeing, you know, somebody kind of called me out on saying, I was like, I learned a lot from COVID and just how much power the government will take. And I was like, that's never happening to me again. And someone called, pushed back and said, I disagree. There will be something, if anything, you should take from this. It's that it's how powerful a motivator fear is for humans. Because it was like, maybe it won't be COVID or a virus, and maybe you'll be a little bit more suspicious, but it's a very powerful motivator to get people in line. And we all fall prey to it. Pretty easily, actually.
This year, Spiked is celebrating its 25th birthday. 25 years ago, Spiked was a pioneer of online political journalism, and now we are bigger than ever. We're reaching people around the world with our articles, essays, videos, and podcasts, all underpinned by our principled message of freedom, democracy, and progress. This would never have happened without you. Our listeners, readers, and supporters. Your donations fund our work and your enthusiasm spreads the word about it. So as we mark Spike's 25th birthday, we want to say a heartfelt thank you. And we're asking those who can afford it to donate to our anniversary appeal in order to keep Spike going and growing into the future. We also have a very special offer on at the moment. Those who donate £25 or more will get a year's membership to Spike Supporters, our online donor community, where you can comment on articles, come to events, and read the site ad-free. This is half of what you'd normally pay for a year's membership. And if you're already a Spike supporter, you can benefit from this offer too. Just make a donation of £25 or more and we'll extend your membership by 12 months. So if you want to support Spiked and get access to some brilliant exclusive perks, go to spiked-online.com/donate. That's spiked-online.com/donate and donate £25 or more to help keep us going for another 25 years. Now on with the show. It's, yeah, the politics on the fifth anniversary of the COVID stuff. I've been thinking a lot about the politics of fear and just its existence almost in everyday life. I mean, Susan Sontag made this point years ago where she said, it's not apocalypse now, it's apocalypse from now on, where everything is seen as this apocalyptic threat. And she was writing about the AIDS crisis, but you could say it about COVID, you could say it about climate change. Everything is not just a problem or a challenge, it's the end of the world. And you just think, what does that do to the human mind when we're constantly primed for an apocalyptic scenario. It certainly doesn't lend itself to kind of forward-thinking, positive, confident people. But, you know, in relation to the anti-Semitism stuff, I did want to ask you about the, you mentioned there the Second World War and the history and all that. I mean, one of the things I find most depressing right now is this kind of turn against Churchill. There are lots of things you can criticize about Winston Churchill, but whenever I see someone now saying, you know, Churchill wasn't the good guy, or Hitler's been wronged, Hitler was more complex, and, you know, we have to think about what was done to Germany and the bombing of Dresden, et cetera, et cetera. I just think this, I think, speaks to that kind of leak of the postmodern attitude from the left to the right, because if you can't even look at that historical moment and say Churchill was infinitely preferable to Hitler and I'm glad Churchill won, if you can't even say that, then aren't you just completely morally lost? What's going on, do you think, with that section of the right?
I wish I was smarter. I mean, I do, because I feel, but maybe it would make things worse. My sister was like, I love being a dumb pleb in the dirt with my guard. And I was like, I get it. And I think more people are actually doing that, because when I think a lot about this stuff, and we, as I was saying, we're kind of at the end of something. I think Trump was the guy that really started it was the beginning of the end. And I don't mean that in the Trump derangement way. I mean that in the sense that Nick Gillespie was saying this when he was on my podcast recently, pre-World War II, even World War I, this idea of the government coming, just putting your head down. These people know what's best for you. The institutions know what's best for you. You just kind of follow along. You go to your school that's like jail and you learn your stuff. And we're at the end of that. People are taking, you know, there's more discussion around school choice. There's in America, there's more in taking personal responsibility. You also have Bitcoin coming in and giving people this kind of freedom with, and a different idea about money and how money can move around. And I think along with that, because I don't know, I hear a lot on the right about this kind of idea of the post-war consensus, which I guess is this idea that the kind of victors wrote the post-war consensus. Churchill was the good guy. We all believe that, and it wasn't true. Now, if you've studied World War II deeply, you know how bad the Germans had it after World War II. You know what the Russians did to the Germans. This isn't like some secret we were keeping. It's just most people don't study that much and learn that much about it. And I think now that it's been kind of, you know, the greatest generation is mostly gone and we're pretty far away from it. And now people can come forward and act like these ideas that weren't a secret have been kept some secret. And then you get traction on social media and all of these bad incentives that reward people for this. And there might be kernels of truth in some of the things they're saying, but then it leads people to draw these much greater conclusions that are generally inaccurate, have been debunked largely, and lead to more and more people blaming the Jews. And so it seems to come in hand with this collapse of the old world because things are so unsettled. And people are unsettled. They do not feel like they have a stable, you know, the world they knew it does not exist. Most people are too busy to contemplate all of this and or even any of it or some of it. But they can perceive it. They can feel it. It's everywhere. If you have kids, you're seeing what, you know, wrestling with, like, I'm like, you guys are talking about having phones in schools. And have we addressed the fact that why would you tell a child to ever do homework again? Like, in the way that they've been told to do it. You know, we have to reinvent learning completely. We've got to reinvent education. You have to AI-proof your classes, which means oral arguments and handwritten. This is what Coleman Hughes was saying on my podcast. He's like, I've AI-proofed my class. You have handwritten exams in person. or write the essays right there in class with a pencil, or you do oral arguments or debates or discussions or oral exams, and that's it. Like that's how you're going to have to do it. You're going to have to prove that you can do it in real time in front of somebody. And you guys are talking about phones and like what? That seems like a discussion we should have been having 20 years ago, and you're having it now. Why?
That's such a good way of putting it, that it feels like the old world is withering away or falling apart, and that can be discombobulating for people. I mean, it has good sides to it, which is that the old politics that wasn't nice for most people is kind of falling down. Globalist institutions are in trouble, and I think a lot of those institutions were pretty undemocratic. But it also means that people will start calling into question some of the moral foundations of the old order, which was that fascism was bad, Hitler was bad, the defeat of Germany was good. I mean, even that gets thrown into question by this kind of strange, as you describe it, the falling off the cliff moment. I think there is a lot of historical ignorance as well, as you say, because I saw someone online recently saying, "Did you know that after Second World War they divided Germany in two?" And I was like, yeah, we all knew that. You know, I'm old enough to remember when there were two countries, one called West Germany and one called East Germany. We know
Oh, geez.
what happened, but we still think it was good that Germany got screwed over by the Allies. You know, so there is so much that's up in the air as a consequence of the shifts, and that can be strange and discomforting.
Do you use AI at all?
No, never. Do you?
I have so I've had a couple conversations with people and I've started using it for just research, like gardening. I was like, I kept bugging my sister and she was like, good luck with all the free time you don't have learning this. And then I was like, I'm gonna ask Grok what to do. And it was amazing and terrifying and amazing at the same time. But this is something I talked to my younger sisters about it who have older kids. And my sister's really funny because she's very realistic about this stuff. And she's always thought the phone debate was dumb. And she's like, you're not putting this genie back in the bottle. My friend and I were joking. We're like, this is like people being like, horses are great when cars come along. It is not, it is a utility. People think of it as something else, but it is truly a tool. And it might be using us, it might be the end of humanity, but there's no putting it back in the bottle. There's just that. And people, I don't, not allowing your kid, like I was saying to Coleman, if you had a kid, how would you t let them use it? He's like, I would let them use it. Because here's another thing. When you have a child and a toddler and they ask you a question, you will never realize what a moron you are until you have a toddler who goes, what's liquid? And you're like, that's a great question. And I should be able to answer it, but I take it for granted and I have no idea. She makes me list every machine that's in this house before I go to bed. And she's like, is the TV a machine? I'm like, I think so. Like, I take television so for granted that I forget that it's a machine. And this isn't going to be her with the, she's living in this world. And he's like, I would just let her, you know, kids just, a lot of parents like let their kids just ask all the questions they have because you go through this phase as a child where you're like, well, why? Well, why? And it's like, well, why is the, we'll be driving. Why are the, does it rain when there are clouds? Well, AI can actually answer that and teach you something. And they absorb everything. So he's like, you know, let them have their questions and use it and just make sure you're teaching them how to think. Like we should be teaching Socratic dialoguing again. We should be teaching media literacy so that they can start to try and discern what's real and what's fake. But Coleman made this brilliant point about how this genie's out of the bottle, and it's really out of the bottle in academia because he said the incentives for the teachers to catch a child cheating using AI are much lower than the incentives for a kid to get away with it. Because for a teacher, they're going to have to maybe it will be an awkward situation. They might have to accuse a student of doing something they didn't do. It could lead to a lot of problem. He was listing all the reasons that it would not be beneficial for them to catch a student using AI versus the student using AI, and he said it was like this arms race between the teachers and the students, and the incentives were so much more for the students that they're clearly gonna win it.
When I read about AI, I suddenly understand why everyone went crazy when the printing press was invented. You know, you read about the printing press being invented in the 1500s and everyone's saying, this is the end of the world. People are going to go insane. And you kind of get it now, although AI is an even larger leap forward. It's one of those tools where you just know that if we use it well, alongside teaching kids properly how to be educated, you just know it could transform things for the better. But at the moment, it feels like this scary thing that no one quite understands.
I want to read books about. I need a good book about when the printing press. I wonder. This is what Sarah Siskind, when she was on my podcast, was saying. Sarah Rose Siskind was saying. She said, if you go back and read the articles and the people, the Luddites, and even that term, she said, was people who were being replaced. It wasn't like, oh, some moral thing of like, this is the humanity. It was really a term that existed because they felt they were being replaced by the Industrial Revolution, which they were. And she was saying, if you go back and read these things, it is indiscernible from what they're writing about AI now, from the printing press. And I mean, it is. I started using it because the first time I ever used it, I was like, this is terrifying. I don't use it to write things. I don't, because it actually, it's not good at that. It's just not. I don't want to sound like AI. It will probably get better very quickly, but and we're all going to be replaced. And Sarah Rose Siskind did say this. She said, I feel like there's just an inherent insecurity that humans have when they're dealing with AI, where it's like, don't be so insecure, use it as a tool. So I've started just playing with it for those aspects, but also because it's a reminder of like how deeply terrifying it is. Why, when you see it just spit out a very coherent, organized, you're like, holy shit, this is freaking wild. It's wild.
The people who were most terrified of the printing press, of course, were the old monks and the priests, because they were the gatekeepers of information. They handwrote all the Bibles and all the books, and everything had to go through them. And it's the same with the internet revolution over the past 25 years and now the AI revolution. It really is putting the wind up the old gatekeepers, you know, the old editor class, because they are increasingly going to be put out to pasture by the fact that we can. You're a perfect example of this. We can publish whatever we want, whenever we want, without requiring any of that old infrastructure. And I think AI is going to push that even further. Bridget, I've got a couple of more questions I want to ask you before I let you go.
Yeah.
I need to ask you about freedom of speech, which is an issue close to both of our hearts, and how it's faring in Trump's America. I guess the first thing I want to ask you is about Mahmoud Khalil at Columbia University. People will be familiar with this case. He was a he's here. He's in the U.S. on a green card, and I think he's married to an American citizen, or he certainly is partnered with an American person. And he was leading the anti-Israel protests at Columbia. He's been arrested by ICE. If you read some of the coverage, you think he's been kidnapped and disappeared, which is way over the top. But what have you made of that incident? What do you think it tells us about what's going on?
I mean, my instinct is that's not great, but as with any of these things, I've learned to pause until I get more information, just in general, because I've definitely gone with my I've run with my emotional reaction to something. And this is again where I was to go back to the White House meme, the Ghibli meme. Is it crass? Yes. Was it effective? It got the conversation away from Signal. It got, because you look at it, and like I said, just a normie, I'm like, oh no, they're deporting lunch lady. It looked like they were mocking deporting lunch ladies, not knowing any of the context. And I think Mike Solana from Pirate Wires made a great point too about how this is like a new bad art form, which is interesting because they misunderstand that medium completely. And so there's that whole discussion, and we haven't even touched on what all of this means for art. And then you find out she's a fentanyl trafficker, and now you have the left defending this fentanyl trafficker. So it was a sneaky way to get the left on the other side of an 80-20 issue where you're like, I don't feel bad. Get her out of here. And in this instance, too, I feel like I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm going to find out they were somehow actually connected to Hamas. You know, it might seem like something very minor. I mean, the other one was that woman who got like disappeared in a van. But then again, this is like Gestapo stuff. So you're like, are they just reverse engineering excuses to pick these people up who are critical of Israel? Are they actually in? You know, is due process being thwarted? Is like, I don't really know. It feels like in both of these instances, there's a lot of stuff that has me deeply concerned, and also a lot of information that I don't feel like I'm getting about what is actually happening here.
Yeah. And again, it also comes back to that question of, well, who the hell are you to criticize this stuff if you've been supporting things like this for the past 10 years? Because think about the due process question. On a campus like Columbia, male students were being kicked out on the basis of accusation alone, or there were certainly protests for that to happen. There was no sense of due process when it came to the campus rape panic of the past few years. And also, you know, people were cancelled for all sorts of speech, or they were disinvited for being, I don't know, gender critical feminists or whatever else they might be. So you have this, the building up of this culture that completely overrides due process and freedom of speech. And then the left tries to pose, like literally on the streets, as the brave defenders of freedom of speech and universal principles of justice. And it just doesn't work, I think, for most people.
Well, and you had an administration working in conjunction. So maybe it's just because, and again, this is that whole thing with humans where if it's an individual, it means something, but if it's thousands, it means nothing. So the breakout cancel stories were individual stories of people being canceled or being deplatformed or being, you know, demoneyed or whatever, debanked, demoneyed. And you had an administration working in cahoots with the like in conjunction with all of big tech and having them censor masses of people and shadow ban in these very subversive ways that you could argue were suppressing free speech, even if you want to argue that it's a public platform, they can do whatever they want. These are monopolies. They, I mean, there's more competition now, but there's still like Amazon servers are a monopoly. If you get kicked off, you're screwed. So maybe because it was on such a large scale, people didn't understand how it led to the smaller individual, like, well, I don't really care what you have to say about free speech in this instance because you didn't care at all when people were being corralled in their like classrooms and not allowed to walk to class by lunatics. But I think the difference here is that it's an arm of the government that feels very much, you know, ICE is a terrifying name in general. It sounds like the name of a, I mean, even yesterday I was like, oh, who got iced? And they were like, what? Someone said what? I'm like, yeah, I probably shouldn't be using that word as a verb. But it does lend itself to this kind of like, I don't know, barbarism. Barbarism is everywhere. It is in all of us. It is everywhere. It's a culture war. It actually feels that way. It feels, I keep thinking about you and your book and talking about kind of this anti-civilizational behavior that was revealed post October 7th. And I do think that broke everything. Like there was a moment in the aftermath of October 7th where I knew nothing would ever be the same. Things were now fundamentally broken in ways that we would not begin to comprehend for probably decades, maybe 100 years, and that I would probably lose friends. Like it may be in the long term, just seeing the way people behave, the way they talked about this, the way that they kind of morally positioned this I'm not saying Israel is innocent by any means, but I think it can be, you should be very able to condemn Hamas for the atrocities they committed that day. And if you can't, there's a problem. You know, there's something that should not be hard to do. And seeing how many people were kind of quiet or justifying it, like they somehow deserved it, I was like, we're probably, there's going to be a day where that friendship, it goes in two directions. And then you see, like you said, Candace, but these people have massive audiences and they're getting bigger. So, and they're getting more mainstream. And it's like it's definitely being mainstreamed, the that sentiment. And I think this administration is actually pretty pro-Israel. And luckily, Trump is a big enough personality to kind of take a lot of this on. But beyond Trump, I don't know. And I don't think a lot of people in the new right like that he's pro, this is a pro-Israel administration. And that's a big break within the party and within MAGA.
Absolutely. No, you see a lot of that at the moment where they're saying, you know, he's a stooge for Israel. He's Israel first, not America first. You see a lot of that kind of crap in my view. But that brings me nicely onto my last question for you, Bridget, which is about I so strongly agree with you, and we've spoken about this on my podcast and your podcast about just what a revealing moment the post 7th of October moment was in terms of the civilizational values and the fact that here you had one of the worst acts of barbarism of modern times, and there were significant numbers of people in the West who couldn't bring themselves to condemn it. I mean, it was so revealing. And I guess I just want to ask you to finish off where you see things going politically from here. I mean, I'm not asking you to get your crystal ball out, but you mentioned earlier, this it really struck me. You mentioned earlier how I thought it was such an interesting point that a lot of the kind of woke left has abandoned X. I often think about them all on Blue Sky, and it does make me laugh that you have all these people just talking to themselves on Blue Sky, and not one normal person ever looks at that website. But as you say, the knock-on effect for X has been a bit weird because it's like, when you go on the Atkins diet and your body starts to consume all your fat, it's like that with the right. They're just consuming little bits here and there because they're starved of that attack that they used to launch on the left every day. So many weird things are going on in terms of political discussion, the fraying within the right, the crisis of the woke left, Trump doing some good stuff and Trump doing some crazy stuff. And we're
The
still
Greenland
for,
stuff,
yeah.
I'm like, am I missing out? Like, this feels like they know World War III is coming. You know, like the Canada stuff. I'm like, the only way any of this makes sense is if you're like from a risk perspective, which is the only perspective I have in terms of war games, is that you're trying to just get some strategic land for a forthcoming global war. And it's like, that is terrifying. Because I can't imagine why this would be such a huge priority.
Yeah, it is. The Canada stuff is very strange. I did a piece for the New York
It's
Post.
strange unless you realize, like, no, we're going to need, it's going to be the North America against Russia, against China or some shit, you know? It's very unsettling to me. I don't like that.
I wrote a piece for the New York Post saying, listen, Trump, you don't want Canada. There's loads of woke people there, and some of them are quite annoying, so just leave them be. But I guess the question is political discussion. I feel like that's been a thread in what we've been talking about, the importance of political discussion, but the impossibility of it in this current climate where you find yourself hedging your bets or thinking you need to stand up against your opponent rather than express what you really think to be true. What do you see as the future of political discussion? Can it be brought back to an even keel where we're honest with each other, or is it going to be up in the air for the foreseeable future?
Oh, we're fucked. I mean, I'm sorry. We just are. Doesn't it feel like everything is like it's like a mirror was shattered and it's reflecting off of each other and everywhere. And this is it's a like postmodern class. I hate to say it, and this is what we said on Dumpster Fire, but this is how when you read about the end of big civilizations, this is all the stuff that happens. I don't know. You can keep saying this is going to be a golden age, but if people's lives aren't materially getting better and they're constantly afraid that nukes are going to start flying or like what, there's going to be a Tesla firebombing in their city or Antifa's going to start some shit or like, again, most of this is like, I just hate too when the left is like, the right is so violent, the rhetoric. I'm like, you guys are so violent too. And we just have violence in our beings as humans. But also, it seems like this is that piece that I wrote for Spectator about how we've lost the ability to identify, like bipartisan ability to identify a scumbag. And it was a much harder piece than I thought it would be. But it really did lead me to see that, when you kind of accept barbarism or rape in this case, you start excusing that for your team. You've accepted a certain level of barbarism, and it's you're now revert. It's not like we're something's changing, we're regressing. That's what's happening. We're regressing as a civilization. At the same time, we have AI. It is insane. Like we're regressing to tribalism and all the stuff the West was so, you know, Jonah Goldberg wrote that beautiful book about the miracle that the West is, and these 200 years and Judeo-Christian values and Enlightenment values and science, and now people don't trust the science. It's just like, it's so funny that after that huge campaign of trust the science, like people have never trusted science less probably it's since science was a thing. And here we are. I mean, this is it's a very there hasn't really been a point like this, I don't think, where maybe Egypt, where you had all of this like flourishing and technology and all these advances. And then when I was in Egypt, I remember the sands being piled up and the Coptic Christians had been hiding out and all of the things that happened. And I was like, what happened? And our tour guide was like, it literally all this knowledge got buried in the sand. And it was the Dark Ages. And I feel like we're very much in that kind of moment where there's a lot of technology and advances, and probably not even as much as there was in Egypt, because we still have no idea how they even did what they did. And we risk it all being buried in the sand. I mean, even have you noticed how much media's come out where people are living underground? I'm like, please stop. Silo, Severance. I'm like, stop prepping me for life underground. Like, I'm looking at the ocean nostalgically, like it's a memory when I see it. That's not good.
Yeah,
Not good.
maybe we should all prep for the life in the silo. Maybe that's our
Oh,
future.
God. But these are all options that are, you know, my husband jokes. He's like, I lack your ability for catastrophic thinking, but look, like, we're far away from. Like World War II and World War, where those people did not lack that, because you do get desensitized to this stuff in war. You have to. I don't know. So, leaving that on, what's up? Let's leave it on a high note for people, though. What are you optimistic about?
Okay, let's do a high net then. Well, I'm optimistic about the fact that I actually think we're falling off the. I'm not sure that falling off the cliff is the right metaphor. I think it's more like we're at a fork in the road, and I think we've got one foot on the right path and one foot on the wrong path. And you know, the right path, I think, is that people are demanding answers to the questions that they've had for a long time. Who's going to give me economic improvements? Who's going to stop men playing sports against my daughters? Who's going to restore all the values and virtues that society once thought were great, but we've been educated over the past 50 years to think of as terrible? So people are asking those urgent, pressing questions. But as you say, we've got a foot, or as I say, rather, we've got a foot on the other path as well, which is going down somewhere a bit darker and a bit more regressive. And I guess one of the worrying things at the moment is that it's not just the kind of postmodern left going down that road. There are other sections of society going down it too. But I am optimistic about the victories won by gender critical feminists, by populists. I think the European Union, which is a pretty nasty institution, is teetering on the brink of insignificance because European voters have had enough of this stuff. So there is all those groundswells of dissatisfaction which are having interesting consequences. And I do feel positive about that stuff. You do as well, yeah, I think.
I do. And I would say that I'm in my metaphor of falling off a cliff. I'm not saying you're necessarily going to go splat on the ground. I think generally my image is that you land in a turbulent river that then takes you downstream a little bit and rocks you about before you crawl and drag yourself to the shore.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my bet. That's really where I think we are. We're in the falling before we fall into the rapids section.
Yeah. I think you've been watching Severance too much, because that is reminding them about their day out that they had where they were on a cliff edge and in a middle of nowhere with a river.
Oh, yeah, that wasn't there. I think it's, I actually think it's too much Frozen.
Right. Yeah.
Because they go over a waterfall in Frozen and then they've got to survive the earth giant. So that's, I think that's more where I'm like, I don't know that we're going to die, but I don't know that it's going to be pretty.
We'll be all right. We'll get there.
Everyone says that.
We will.
I'm optimistic. I mean, I have to care about stuff like this. I miss the good old days when I didn't.
Bridget, thank you very much.
Maybe I'll start using heroin again. Just kidding.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe, and in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.